This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Firefighting is one of the oldest professions in the world, still a very necessary one. After thousands of years of technological innovations, the best way to put out a fire is still, well, someone going into danger and putting water on it. Today, Where We Live, we're going to meet firefighters and find out how they do what they do and why they do what they do. We'll find out how the profession is changing and how it's one of the last real bastions of volunteerism in our towns and cities. First, we're going to meet Alan Nelson. He's 86 years old. He started as a substitute fireman in New Britain in 1950. He became part of the regular force in 1954 and did that job for 30 years. Where We Live, executive producer Katie Tolarski recently talked to Alan at the New Britain Industrial Museum about his life and his career.
I got married in 1950, and I got on the fire department in 54. I had to work somewhere, and I didn't want to be in a factory, and my wife worked in City Hall, and a fellow across the street asked her to get an application for him because she works in City Hall and she was near there. And so she asked me, do you want one too? So she went and she got him one and she got me one. So I said, okay. So I filled it out. I got on the job and he didn't. But I did get the job and I spent the next 30 years as a fireman. Very exciting job. There's too many stories to tell about a fireman. Firefighting is an exciting job, and it's a dangerous job. It is, and it's changed a lot now than it was years ago. You know, they go out, firemen now go out on medical calls, and we didn't do that in those days. We were firemen, and we just went to fires. Not any little kid gets a sliver in his finger, they send a fire truck down to find out why. You know, they do that now all the time. They never did that years ago. You know, our restriction was to firefighting, and that's what we did. And I enjoyed it. It was a fun job. There were some big fires in New Britain, the Night of Fires you probably heard about, 1971, when the factory burned up on Franklin Square, American Hydro. That was a real exciting night. I was a pump operator. Yeah, factory was empty, and it was a fire over a lumber yard and like a bunch of houses. They all burnt, but everybody got out of them. No, there were no loss of life, which was good. It was a June night, nice and warm and drizzly raining night, you know. It started burning. Oh boy, people were coming in from all over. It was exciting. It really was, and they still talk about it. The Night of Fires. Firefighting was always an exciting job, and a very hazardous job too. Yeah, to this day, it's a hazardous job. But, you know, you did it, and you never thought much about it, and you just did what you had to do. I retired, hate to tell you, 1984. That's a long time ago. I retired in 84. And once you're retired, you cut all your strings with it, you know. You go there a few times to talk to the guy, but slowly the guys start disappearing. If I went down there today, I don't know anybody in there. They don't know me. Oh, were you a fireman? They probably don't even know that. Other than I ride a bike and they see me and they know that. But other than that, it changed a lot. It was good. It was exciting. Anything else you want to talk about?
Yeah. Yeah, there is, Alan. That's Alan Nelson, 86 years old. He was part of the New Britain Fire Force for 30 years. He talked with executive producer Katie Tolarski at the New Britain Industrial Museum. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live. Today, we're going to get to know some local firefighters, and we want to hear from you, 860-275-7266. You can tell us stories about the firefighters in your community. Maybe you have someone in your family. Maybe you fought fires yourself. We want to hear from you, 860-275-7266. You can also email us wherewelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at Where We Live. We want to hear about how this profession has changed and some of your stories. I want to welcome in Jim O'Neill, who's Assistant Chief of the Thomaston Fire Department, and he's President of the Connecticut State Firefighters Association. Jim, welcome to our program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Listening to Alan there, I'm sure all firefighters have great stories. I'd like to hear how you got started in this.
How I got started? It was really a fluke. It was really, we had a friend of the family I grew up with who was the local fire chief. And that seemed kind of like really exciting to watch him drive through town and, you know, all that kind of stuff with the sirens and the lights. And I said, well, before I get old and, you know, somehow get married and have kids and all this stuff and say, gee, I should have done that 20 years ago. At 18, I joined the department and kind of got hooked on it and have been there ever since.
How have you seen it change since the time you started? And when was that exactly, if you don't mind me asking? come on now.
The first Monday in November, 1976.
1976. So it's obviously changed quite a bit. Give me a sense of how the profession has changed.
It's a lot more technical. I think it's a lot safer than it was back then. Some of the technologies in the world have driven that. I mean, when we first got in, you know, there was no such thing as breathing apparatus. You didn't wear that stuff. You held your breath and you went in the fire and you ate the smoke and you came back out and that's what you did. You know, if you wanted to look for that thing in the box called the breathing apparatus, they'd laugh at you and say, real firefighters don't wear those. But again, in that day in the late 70s into the early 80s, you know, it was still what we call Class A combustibles. It was wood. It was paper. It was wool. It was things that weren't necessarily highly toxic. You know, around the early 70s came the more advent of plastics in home use, and then the world changed and everything became highly toxic. And that's driven a lot more standards for breathing, all for the better. I mean, the requirements for firefighter safety have improved 100-fold in the past 30 years. You know, you name it, it's changed. Apparatus specimen. We used to go out and ride the back step. That's how we got to fires. You know, now more no one ride. You know, it's all enclosed cabs, seat belted. You know, anything in the cab has to be bolted down so that it's not a projectile and all this. All these things have happened.
Well, and all these things have happened, and I think it's obvious that many of them, from a safety standpoint, are for the better. Mm-hmm. I grew up with a firefighter in my family, my uncle, and he said things very much like you said, and like our earlier guest said. You know, it's just what you did. There's a little bit of a sense, especially when you get into it at a young age, maybe in the 60s or 70s, where there was a real bravado about it. I mean, did you feel that, and do you feel like some of that has changed? Maybe you can talk about the changing nature of what it means to be a firefighter in terms of a little bit of that bravado of, you know, I'm going to go in there, hold my breath, and just do what needs to be done.
Wow. Oh, I don't know if you want to call it bravado. I think back then, it was also the local fire department, in some cases, be it career or volunteer, were the social enclaves of the town. It was, you know, it was the most elite club in town to belong to. And there were plenty of social stuff and all sorts of things like that to do, along with fighting fires. There's still a lot of bravado, still a lot of pride in what we do today. It's just changed a little bit, you know. The world has changed. I can't speak for my other two panelists, but, you know, in my town used to be a mill town. You know, we had we're only 12 square miles, but we had three or four major factories, and a good portion of the firefighters worked in the factories. And the factories, when the horn went off in the center of town, go and just go fight the fire and come back when you're done. And, oh, by the way, you're still on the clock. Don't worry about it. I mean, the chief worked in one of those factories, and when worldwide companies came around to see if they wanted to buy the product from this world-renowned factory, they would make it a point of bringing it into the engineering room and introducing him to – his name was Robert Brown. And they'd say, this is Robert Brown, and he's our local fire chief. So it was a very – you know, it was kind of a status thing. It still is, but again, most communities today have turned from industrial into bedroom communities, which then creates a whole different set of circumstances because you don't necessarily have the responses you used to have right away. You don't have 25 or 30 firefighters coming to a call where you know what you used to see. You know, you're at times it's 5, it's 10, maybe less at times. I still think the bravado's there. I just think that the thought process has changed. The generation today doesn't look at it the same way as we do as far as the other things that make a fire department, you know, function. But still great.
We're going to be bringing in some firefighters of other generations, mm-hmm, in just a moment. And we want to hear from you at 860-275-7266. Catherine's on the line from Suffield. Hi, Catherine. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on the bravery and the pride that I know about in the firefighting business. I have a great friend, Kathy, whose husband, Sam, is a fire marshal and a fire chief. and they have two sons, young Sam, who went into firefighting, and then Larry, who went into firefighting, and Kathy and her daughter Samantha are totally supportive, and they have a great sense of pride. This whole family is entrenched in supporting firefighting. And Kathy laughs because she says there's a sense of craziness in a firefighter who, when everyone else is running out of a burning building, the firefighters are running in.
Oh, Catherine, thank you so much for sharing that story. I really appreciate it. And we actually, at the very top of our program, we played a little clip from a Prairie Home Companion in which Garrison Keeler was talking to a firefighter about that impulse. Can you just explain that quickly, Jim, the impulse to run toward flames when all the rest of us are going, oh, my God, we're running the other direction?
It's our training. It's what we do. You know, it's – I think it's a niche that people that get involved in the fire service just automatically respond to. You know, I think everybody in emergency services, and I'll say that globally, has a niche. You know, I've met with friends of mine in town and other towns who do EMS, and they're like, I could never do what you do. I could never go into that burning building. I'm going, well, you know what? Sincerely, I could never do what you do. I'm not into the EMS. That just doesn't do anything for me. In the sense of I can't function in that environment of people that are hurt, really hurt and really injured, where you have to really do something, you know, in a medical profession. So it's, you know, and the same thing as, you know, police officers, you just, you know, they do what they do because, you know, yeah, we're trained and it's what we do. We train to go into buildings and put fires out. That's what we do. And, you know, a lot of, you know, we do it without, it's all, what's the right word I'm looking for? Instinct. It's all instinct when we do it. It's more of an instinct and reaction than it is, you know.
Well, let me bring in Matthew Troy, who's a firefighter, an emergency medical technician, a past lieutenant of the Hebron Fire Department. Matthew, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. I'm very excited to be here.
I'm going to ask you about your story and why you became a firefighter. But could you just pick up on what Jim was talking about that impulse or the training, why you would run toward a flame when the rest of us are running away?
Well, certainly. When you talk to any firefighter, a lot of them will say it's, you know, firefighters are born into this. And I think that is very much, maybe it's an instinct maybe not to run into a burning building, but an instinct to help people. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, we have this very unique set of skills and training and a passion that just happens to involve running into a burning building or running into the middle of a hurricane or any of these other types of emergencies that afflict communities. And when others are in need, I guess we have the training, we have the resources and tools to be there to help people get out and try to turn that situation around so that everyone can return back to normal.
Could you tell us the story of why you became a firefighter?
Certainly. When I was a child, I lost someone very close to my family. My father passed away of a heart attack when I was 11 years old. And that was the first time I ever had to call 911. And I remember vividly that day, the guys that showed up at my house were friends, classmates, fathers, and brothers. These gentlemen that I knew from the community as my neighbors, and I'd never seen them wearing this different uniform. And here they are in my house, taking my father to the hospital, and it always stuck with me, particularly one of my past chiefs was there, and he was a father of a very good friend of mine. And over the years, that really kind of stuck with me that I really wanted to help people. I didn't want to be that person sitting in traffic rubbernecking on the other side of the road. I wanted to be on the other side helping. When I became 16, I had a friend that was in the volunteer fire department, and I asked him, hey, you know, what's the deal with that? How do I get into it? And next day he showed up with an application, and I put it in, and next thing I knew, I was already on my way to start EMT training, because in the state of Connecticut, you can be an EMT at the age of 16. To be an interior firefighter, you have to be 18. So I actually started as a EMT in the Hebron Fire Department, and over the years, I think getting to know all the firefighters and all the wonderful things they do and how all the cool things that they were talking about, I wanted to do that as well. So I started my firefighter training as well.
And you've been a firefighter now for 10 years?
10 years. This past Sunday marked my 10-year anniversary in Hebron.
My goodness. Congratulations.
Thank you
that.
Very much.
10 years being a firefighter, mind if I ask how old you are?
I'm 26. I'll be 27 next month. And what's a little scary is at 26 years old, I'm one of the more veteran members of the fire department. I have a lot of remarkable firefighters that I look up to that have put in 25, 30. We have one gentleman that's going on 55 years, and they're role models to me. But I also have a wave of younger members that I hope are looking up to me. It's kind of scary at 26 that I'm a veteran member of this fire department.
Well, and that's really interesting to me. We have an awful lot of conversations here, whether it's about education or other topics, in which there is a sense that the millennial generation isn't as engaged in what's going on in their communities. You know, they're content to be on their iPhones or in front of a screen someplace, that they don't really want to be on the other side of the highway helping out in a crash. I'm not saying any of this is right. I'm just saying it's a perception in America today. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because there is a perception that people your age just don't want to get involved in something that's like helping your community in this way.
Well, I think that's I hate to say it, but I think that is a fair perception. A lot of our younger members are actually they're multi-generation firefighters. I'm first-generation firefighter. No one in my family had ever done this before. But a lot of our youngest members that are starting in high school, they have fathers, mothers, older siblings that are doing this. We absolutely go out and try to recruit younger members because we are looking for those educated, healthy, and honestly, members that are rather available. They don't have those full-time jobs yet. They don't have families that they're committed to or PTA meetings to go to or anything like that. We're trying to find those younger members, and it's difficult. We're talking about how the fire service has been trying to adapt and change with the times. I think a big part of it is looking at society and how do we reach out to communities to engage those younger members, using social media to try to encourage more people to come, trying to find just those different benefits that can draw members of all generations.
Maybe some of our conversation today will spark some folks into being interested in this. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. If you have stories about firefighters in your family, or if you are a firefighter yourself, we'd love to hear from you. I want to welcome in Corey Kelly, who's a firefighter and an emergency medical technician in Middletown. Some of you may have read a profile of her in the Middletown Press. Corey, welcome to our program. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So why are you a firefighter?
You know, I get asked that question all the time, and there's not just one thing that I can say. Like Matt said, there's one turning point in my life. The easiest one is I'm nosy. I like knowing what's going on, and then I want to help when people are hurt or injured. When I was young growing up, my grandfather was very involved in his fire department, his volunteer fire department. So I would go to the fire department with him, and I would see him help other people. And then my parents were involved in our volunteer in their town that I grew up in. So then I would see them running out of the house to go help people. I always wanted to be the one sitting there going and helping people and knowing what's going on and not the one sitting back in the side eye. There's also a sense of adrenaline. You never know what's going to happen. You never know what call is going to come in. You never know actually when you get there what call came in, if it matches what is going on. It's just, it's a huge rush, and then you always get a sense of satisfaction that you did get to help somebody and you did get to make a difference.
The first thing you always get asked is, why are you a firefighter? And then
yes.
The second question you always get asked, and I'm going to fall right into this, is, well, so you're a woman firefighter, and it seems as though, and we'll get some statistics in a bit, that there aren't as many women fighting fires as there are men fighting fires. Do you ever see that as a barrier? What's it like being a woman firefighter?
It's challenging. There are times, like I said, I started out as a volunteer, and I was one of the more active women firefighters in my volunteer department. I went to the academy class, and there was 33 of us, and I was the only female. And then I started out in my career department as the only female. There's a lot of barriers, but if you don't think about it as you're a female and you just show them that you're doing the same thing, you had the same training, you had the same knowledge that they have, you're there to learn, you're there to continue your learning, and you're there to be a team player. And not to show the guys that you work with that you're going to play on the part that you're a woman. Fire doesn't know that I'm a girl. When I put my gear on, no one knows that I'm a girl. I go in, fire's not going to go easier on me because I'm a female. Fire's not going to go easier on me because I'm career. The guys that are volunteer, fire doesn't know that. You go in, you got to get the job done.
When you say there are barriers, I mean, what are some of the barriers?
The easiest one is I'm short. I have to constantly hit the gym, make sure that I am at the same strength as the guys that I work with. The wives, when I go to work, count on me to have their husband's back. If something happens in a fire, they're my brothers. I'm going to take them out. So I have to be able to know full-heartedly that I will be able to pull them out of a fire if I need to.
We're talking with three firefighters in studio, and we're going to get some more calls and thoughts at 860-275-7266. We're talking with Corey Kelly and Matthew Troy and Jim O'Neill. They're all firefighters here in Connecticut. We're going to talk about the volunteerism aspect. We're going to talk about some of their firefighting stories. We're also going to talk about those who go out and fight forest fires out west a little bit later on. We want to hear from you. You can also email us where we live at WNPR.org. As we head to break, this tweet from Meg: Dad joined the local fire department after starting a brush fire in our back lot. Funny anecdote, but now it's a big part of his life. You can keep our tweets at Where We Live coming here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today on the program, we're meeting some of the people who do a very important thing in our community. They fight fires. Some are volunteers and some are professional firefighters. Some volunteers get paid. We'll talk about that. We'll find out a little bit more about what firefighters in 2014 do and how that has changed over the years. We have a panel of great firefighters here in our studio, and we're taking your calls at 860-275-7266, including Henry, who's calling from Columbia. Hi there, Henry. You're on Where We Live.
Yeah, hi, John. I think it's probably a little bit of an interesting story. When I was a young adult, I was an EMT in the town I lived in, and I really enjoyed that. And then I got divorced and moved and dropped it. So I did that for a few years, but I found that very satisfying. Well, at the ripe old age of 58, I retired, and I decided, well, you know, I'd like to be an EMT again. So I went to the local fire department to where I moved, and, yeah, they had a fire department, and they had EMTs and firefighters. So I trained to be an EMT again, and great, okay, now I'm an EMT. But, you know, it sounded exciting to be a fireman, too. So anyway, I always enjoyed hiking and mountain climbing. I was kind of an outdoorsy type person and, you know, liked the little adrenaline rush of climbing up a mountain and so forth. So I said, gee, okay, I'll give it a try. So I went to the firefighting school in Willimantic. So, you know, I was pretty much old enough to be the grandfather of some of those people there. But anyway, I did it. I'm not a very big guy. I'm only 5'2". But anyway, I really enjoyed that. I remember being really frightened because we had to climb up a three-story fire training building with our full gear and an air pack and...
Hold on for a second, Henry. Matthew Troy is smiling at me about this. Go ahead.
Actually, Corey and I are both Henry, I'm over in Hebron, and Corey and I both went to the Willimantic Fire Training School. We know exactly the tower you're talking about and that ladder. Oh, yeah.
So anyway, so I'm there. I'm 58 years old. And there's girls there, 18, 19 years old. So, okay, well, you know, they now have female firemen. That's great. So anyhow, I remember climbing up that thing and the three-section ladder, and I'm a little guy, and climbing in, and I said, wow. Yeah, that was an adrenaline rush. I kind of thought there's a fine line between being courageous and foolish, and I was wondering where it was. But anyway, okay, so I became a member of the Eagleville Fire Department.
Yeah.
And I spent a few years there, and... I was too old. They didn't let me go into any fires except one. And I did save a life. However, it happened to be a parakeet.
Henry, that's an I'm going to let you go because we got a lot of more people to call. But that's an amazing story. We're going to take some more phone calls in just a moment. I want to ask you guys, well, Henry leads us right into that. What's your story? I mean, if someone says, Corey, you got to tell us a story about being a firefighter, what's the story? I mean, Henry's got the parakeet story, which is a great story, but what's your story?
The one that always sticks out, I mean, we always have the traumas, the ones that we sleep over at night. But the one that always reminds me of why I do what I do is it was around Christmas time. We got a call for a infant, probably a month old infant, not breathing, choking. We got there and the mom was frantic holding this blue baby. I look over and there's another baby and a little bouncer, whatever they're called. And it was her twin. They were preemies and she had choked on something that she got a hold of. I was able to make the baby breathe again, and I wouldn't let anybody touch that baby until the ambulance came and was able to take her away. Afterwards, I had the mother and the two babies came and they thanked me. That Christmas, the father came. He was serving overseas at the time that it happened.
Wow.
Every Christmas, they come and they say hi and they thank me. And they're probably four now.
Wow.
Yeah.
And they will always thank you. So. That's a great story. That's a great story. Jim, how about you? You probably got a lot of stories over the years. What's a story you tell when someone says, you know, I don't know what it's like being a firefighter. Tell me a story, Jim.
Wow. So many. It's tough to pick one. Well, I guess the one that sticks in my mind, and we've had a few over the years, is kind of on the same vein as Corey's, but unfortunately not the same outcome. It was my first fire as an assistant chief. It was 87, 88. It was the old brass mill caught fire Saturday afternoon. That was the upside of it. I mean, guys came, did a great job. We held it in check. It was a long duration because it was a funny designed roof, and it was slate, so you kind of can't get through slate roofs as easily as shingled roofs or other things. But the guys did a really good job. We saved it. We kept it in the area. It was great. And as we're going into what they call the overhaul phase to try to start pulling things apart and make sure there was no hot spots, we got a call. This was in January. We got a call for a couple of kids that had been sliding down a hill across the Naugatuck River on a little tributary, and one of them went through the ice.
Oh.
And so, of course, we immediately had a shift from there to the second piece, and unfortunately it was too late when we found them. And that's the one that's always stuck in my head because it was just such a, you know, a good job at one end and a good job at the other, but the outcome wasn't the same. And you know, and I've, you know, and people have asked me what was the difference of that day. I says I would have traded that building to be able to save if we were able to save that individual.
Wow, and that is, boy. First of all, I mean, I think just the fact is, I think a lot of the job is that you wait for things to happen, that there's not always things happening every day.
No.
And then two things like that happen at the exact same time. And it's not you making a choice. It's just it's the way it played out. Ugh.
Yeah. You know, you just respond automatically and go to the next call. It just wasn't, you know. That was a tough one.
But I think you raise another important issue is that we have a lot of structures, mm-hmm. Especially old structures, and some of them may burn and it may be a loss historically, mm-hmm. But there may not be any loss of life, and then there may be something that seems very minor, and it could be someone's life in your hands. That's a hard thing.
That's a tough one. I think to me the motor vehicle accidents are sometimes the toughest because we've been to some where you have seen you roll up and there is, for lack of a better word, total devastation. You know, parts of the car like all over the neighborhood, so to speak, and the person is sitting on the front step of the house next door, you know, and then you respond to another motor vehicle accident where it's very minor damage, very much not much of anything, and it turns out to be a fatal, and there's just no rhyme or reason. So yeah, you need to kind of check it and be able to react to whichever situation. Because there are no definites in what we do. There's not a defined line of, you know, positive, negative. It could go any type of call can go any way at any time.
We're going to get to some more of your phone calls in just one moment at 860-275-7266. But I'd like to hear the story that you would like to tell us, Matthew, about being a firefighter.
Well, you know what's funny is if a bunch of my brothers are listening, they're all sitting there going, he better not tell a fire story because my nickname is the White Cloud in the department. And the White Cloud in the fire service means fires just don't happen to really ignite when I'm around. And the moment I leave town, something is burning. And So hopefully a bunch of them are laughing right now. But I have been to my share of fires. But like Jim was saying, it's a lot of the motor vehicle accidents, or Corey was saying, these medical calls. It's that very personal connection with a person, you know, with a human being that sticks with me. In particular, I have this one gentleman in my fire department, Dave, that told me when I first joined as a young kid, he said, you know, you're going to go to a lot of stuff in this job, but every once in a while, you'll actually do something truly, truly good. And for me, that was back in 2010 when I was just about to leave town. We had a two-car head-on crash right in front of the elementary school. And we had two individuals that were heavily pinned inside the vehicle. And I was the very first one there, not because I received the 911 call over my pager, but it happened in the front yard of a friend of mine. And they said, can you come over here? So I was there first. And the reason it sticks out in my mind, not only was that everyone ultimately survived and is doing well from that accident, but that this was the ultimate demonstration of how a volunteer department struggles but also comes together in a time of need. It was 8 a.m., work day, school just started, and when the call came out, we had four guys that showed up with an ambulance, a rescue truck, myself, and a chief. We had two LifeStar helicopters coming on our way, and this was a great example of teamwork, not only within our own department but mutual aid departments, meaning we call nearby towns to also come and help us to fill in those needs. And working with the Jaws of Life and freeing these two young individuals was probably one of the proudest moments of my 10 years in the fire service.
Wow. If you want to share some stories, 860-275-7266. Let's go to Bernie, who is calling from East Hampton, and we're going to try to take Bernie's call right now. Hi, Bernie. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hello, John, and the other firefighters. My brother firefighters, I might add, have a great respect for the work you do, and I can echo all of your sentiments. I had spent 32 years in the Meriden Fire Department, and I recognize all the stories that you're telling and the feeling that come along with that. Nobody calls us when they're having a good day. It's always bad news, and we do the best we can. The happy endings are probably a rarity sometimes. But one thing I wanted to address that I haven't heard is the name of the fire department. We really are the Department of Emergency Services, because today's fire department provides fire prevention, public fire education, fire suppression, hazardous material mitigation, technical rescue, emergency medical services, and community involvement. We're so involved with the community, far beyond the fire departments of yesteryear. And it's come a long way just in my 32 years. And I just wanted to add that to the conversation. It's really grown exponentially. The training is infinitely more important. You really train like your life depends on it, and the life of the people.
Well, Bernie, thank you very much for raising that. It's something that we wanted to talk about anyway, so I'm really glad you took us in this direction. Cordy, do you want to jump in?
He's absolutely 100% mm-hmm. right. I mean, as a career firefighter, it's kind of different. When I go into work, we get training right then. Volunteers, they have one training night a week, so it's a little bit harder for them to get all the training that they need to get and to get the people there at the same time at the same place. But the thing that we always go back to and the thing that everybody has to think about is if the cops can't shoot it or arrest it, if the town can't plow it, then they call the fire department and we're supposed to be able to fix everything else. Mm-hmm. We've gotten calls for just a whole mirage of different things, from squirrels stuck in a feeder and we have to tell them, okay, this is what needs to be done, or help them out, to actual fires and emergencies. A lot of fire departments these days are trained in what's called Rescue Corps, which is just your basics, and then everything gets built on that. So it's your trench rescue, your confined space, your highline rescue. And we're expected to know all that, plus do firefighting, plus do hazardous materials, and plus do EMS work. So we're kind of the jack-of-all-trades type deal.
And this idea of emergency response, that's really what our caller was talking about. It's all those things.
Absolutely.
Can you explain the difference between being a career firefighter and a volunteer firefighter? I understand there's many more volunteer firefighters in Connecticut than there are career firefighters. Maybe you can just explain what being a career firefighter means, Corey?
For the most part, generally, most career firefighters have gone through Windsor Locks Academy, which is the 15 weeks class where you sleep there, you stay there you form a brotherhood there. Volunteers, they go through different kind of courses. Like Matt was saying before, there's the one that's in Romantic where you go every other weekend. Same thing, it mirrors all the education the same, just a different around a volunteer schedule. Volunteers have to work. They have essentially two jobs. They go to their real job and then they go home and they go to their volunteer job. Like I said before, a fire doesn't know if you're career paid or a career volunteer. You just happen to get paid for it.
But something I want to understand is do volunteer firefighters, Matthew, get paid?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. Really, some of them do.
Some of them do, and it depends on the municipality. And what's interesting about Connecticut is we have a lot of fire departments. We don't run on a county system here. Pretty much every town or even fire districts within a community have their own fire departments. So,
and just to break it down, with 169 towns and various fire districts within each town, we're talking something like 300 fire districts or something like that?
Something like that, yeah. And I think – and forgive me, I don't have the statistics, but I think almost three-quarters of the state are volunteer departments or some version of a volunteer combination with a few paid individuals. So volunteers, there are towns where you don't get – anything. They generally, your training is paid for, your equipment is paid for, and to allow you to do the job. But some communities, you might get a small stipend, $10 per ambulance call, something like that. Whereas on a career staffing, yes, you are on payroll. You get those benefits. It really depends on the community.
Can you flesh this out a little bit more for us, Jim? I mean, those numbers are about right. We saw statistics that there are maybe 27,000 or so firefighters in Connecticut, and maybe about 4,000 of them are career firefighters.
Okay, that's probably true. Yes, that
I don't have, sounds about
again,
right.
Yeah, I don't have the numbers in front of me, so I'm gonna agree with you. Yes, that's correct.
This idea that a lot of towns rely on volunteer firefighters, yes. I assume that means that a lot of the fire departments in many towns are subject to the whims of the economy and the local budgets. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that year to year, it's tough for some fire districts, for some fire departments to actually survive.
It gets difficult. I think if I understand your question right, I think it's that's the fire service across the board.
Sure.
Whether you're career volunteer, the career people, you know, they have to fight the budgets and the same thing that we do. The only big difference I think is that we are looking, we're fighting for budget cuts. We're working on budget cuts, worrying about the training, a little bit of the training aspect, where the money's going to go, budget cuts, not equipment. Where the major line item in a career department is the salary benefits line item, and that's what, you know. But we're all there fighting. Whether you're career or volunteer department, you're all still sitting before your boards of finance fighting for the same dollar.
Well, and I guess – and that was really my question is times it seems are tight in municipal budgets all the time. And so this is probably something, Corey, in your town that you face and in every other community they face, that with all the work that you do, the fact that you are first responders in so many different ways, you still have to fight for a budget in order to get paid every year.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Every single year we have to go and solicit votes, tell people what we do. And make it so that the taxpayers realize what we do and what we provide, and that the tax money that they're paying, if it's even a couple bucks increase a year, that's actually going to help us help them. We need the new equipment.
Yes.
We need to be able to provide our safety equipment so we can safely help them. There are so many departments that have gear that should be retired by now. But they can't afford to get new things.
We're talking today with Corey Kelly and Matthew Troy and James O'Neill. They're all firefighters here in Connecticut. They're sharing their stories, and we're taking some of yours at 860-275-7266. When we come back, we're going to find out more about some firefighters in Connecticut who go fight fires elsewhere, especially big forest fires. We don't have those here, but other parts of the country sure do. Heading out, we've got a tweet from another Corey. When my child was nearly born at home unexpectedly this year, firefighters arrived before the EMTs. I'm very grateful to them. I owe you thank yous. You can tweet your thank yous at Where We Live to us, and we'll be back right after this break. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's program, a recent report from the CDC estimates that 1 in 68 children has autism. That's a 30% increase from the year 2012. We'll talk to a panel of autism experts about the meaning behind these statistical trends. We'll also look at disparities in autism diagnosis and see what's being done to create better services in our state. That's our conversation coming up on Mondays, Where We Live. I hope you can join us. I also hope you can join me on stage at the Bushnell. Maybe we won't invite you up on stage, but you can be in the Bushnell in the audience to be part of a conversation I'm having with renowned author Dan Brown, who wrote, of course, The Da Vinci Code. And apropos of today's conversation, his most recent book called Inferno. We're going to be speaking on stage as part of a fundraiser for the Mark Twain House. You can go to the Mark Twain House website for more information about tickets. You can also check out our website, WNPR.org, and read a little preview where Dan Brown talks about overpopulation, global warming, and a little bit about God. Today, we're talking with firefighters. We're talking about the job, the very difficult job of fighting fires in our communities, volunteerism, and working hard to be first responders in certainly a very changing world. We're talking with Jim O'Neill, who's an assistant chief with the Thomaston Fire Department and is also president of the Connecticut State Firefighters Association. Matthew Choi is a firefighter in the Hebron Fire Department, and Corey Kelly is a firefighter in the Middletown Department. I'm going to welcome in some more of your calls in a moment at 860-275-7266. But quickly, I want to welcome in Christopher Martin, who's Director of Forestry for the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, to talk about something that we haven't mentioned yet. Christopher, welcome to our show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, John. Thank you for having me.
You know, we don't see massive forest fires here in Connecticut like we see out west. Do we have forest fires here in Connecticut at all?
Well, we do, and they are nothing compared to out west. However, in Connecticut, we do have a very high percentage of wildland-urban interface, where the houses and the trees are kind of intermixed on our landscape. So even small fires really need quick attention.
Because we don't have as many fires like that, these massive brush fires that we see in California seemingly every year these days, maybe you can talk about the relationship that Connecticut has with the rest of the country for fighting forest fires, because we do send people out to help.
We do, and we are part of a national incident management system in Connecticut through the Forestry Division at DEEP. Each state has a wildfire crew that's specifically trained for these fires out west and in the southeast. They're extensively trained, annual refresher and weekend work. And they're about crews of 20 that we send out upon request from the USDA Forest Service.
These crews of 20, it seems as though this may be something that the nation might have to think about even beefing up more, because every year these fires get larger and larger in the western United States. Do you think, Christopher, that this may be coming, a real need to engage a larger group of people to fight fires in these places where they seem to happen all the time?
Well, last year there was over 4 million acres burned in the United States at a cost of $1.7 billion. There was a short period of time last summer where the nation went to the highest preparedness level, level 5, and basically all available resources were engaged in firefighting somewhere in the United States. That's very unusual, and it was only for a short period of time, but it seems so every summer there's more and more fires indeed. There's a lot of tree mortality out west, certainly in the Colorado area, from pine bark beetle, and so when fires start, they become much hotter, much quicker, and expand very quickly.
I want to ask my panelists, have any of you ever done this, and would you go do this, head out there?
I know that among the firefighting community, at least the structural firefighting, is that forest firefighting is considered one of the most dangerous. Mm. It's always been something that's interested me. I've never actually been able to take the test for DEEP.
Is it much different, Christopher? It strikes all of us as being very, very dangerous. Is it much different than fighting structural fires?
It is. The bravery is the same, and the training is very similar. However, in wildfire fighting, the techniques are different. Sometimes you're fighting fire with fire, backfiring to prevent spread. And other times you're in very rough terrain. You're not going in kind of in a controlled area, and you're very suspect to winds and changing weather.
Christopher Martin's Director of Forestry for the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. Thank you so much for joining us, Chris. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Let's go to Donna, who's calling from Southington. Donna, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to just tell a quick little story with my own experience with the fire department.
Yeah.
To say thank you to the first responders. I crashed my motorcycle, and they were the first responders, and they were concerned because it was the Meriden Fire Department, and they actually call the coroner, death coroner. So they were very happy to find me alert, and I have to give them credit for their humor. They actually had me laughing as they were doing what they needed to do to package me up and get me to LifeStar. And about a year later, I went back, and there were about seven people in the room, and I only recognized two. And then I had my head turned, and this one gentleman spoke, and I quick turned my head, and they all started laughing. And they said, "You don't recognize him, do you?" And I said, "No." I said, "But the his voice." And they go, "Yeah, that's what we call him, the voice. He's the one who was at your head, keeping you calm and talking to you and stuff."
My goodness. And Donna, thank you for sharing that story. And I think, you know, this idea of using humor as well, of trying to put people at ease. This is an important part of the job, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think every firefighter who is truly born into the profession has that sense of humor that, while some people from the outside may see it as sick and maybe a little sadistic, it's how we cope. It's how we get through the day. It's how we deal with the tough calls. It's when we get back, it's the brotherhood of it.
Yeah. Did you want to jump in, Jim?
No, I just agree wholeheartedly, and I think it depends on the situation too. I see it a lot. I've seen a lot over the years when, you come back from a job, a structure type of thing, and you've done a good job and there's some humor and everybody's doing the high fives. Again, I think I can say this collectively, it's not quite the same when you go to an MVA or something like that. There's not a lot of humor, not a lot of fun. It's a very serious thing. We come back, if someone's seriously injured or fatal, it affects us. And you introduce a little bit of humor to try to cut the edge, but it's just a whole different mindset. Again, the folks that are career, and I'm fortunate, I'm honored, because my oldest son is now a next generation. He's a career firefighter in the city of Stanford, and he loves it. That's what he did from the time he joined the Explorer program in my department, and he went off and became a firefighter. So I've heard the humor, and I've sat around their table occasionally with the stories, and it's how we cope.
Oh yeah, without a doubt. I mean, I was pointing out I have a nickname, so it's humor. If they're not picking on you, if you're not joking around with your brothers, then something's wrong.
Yes.
And
yes,
they pick on me quite a bit, so I guess I'm doing okay.
We have a little bit less than a minute left, so I just need a quick answer here. I always hear that firefighters, when they get together, the food's really good. And is this right? Is this right? Is the cooking really good?
You gain a lot of weight your first year in the fire department.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to look at your career. So you eat all the time with your guys.
When we cook.
So you guys cook a lot, as opposed to volunteers who are just about to take a bite out of a sandwich when they've got to run out the door, right?
That's exactly it. I mean, it always seems that you're sitting down to dinner when the pager goes off.
Yes. Usually a good dinner. Steak. I don't know how many steak dinners I've missed in 30-something years of just being, I'm cooking steak tonight. Okay, dear. Forget about it. It's coming off the grill and I'm going out the door.
Well, go ahead quickly.
I just want to say one thing. Yeah. I mean, we've been talking a lot about being firefighters, and at least in the volunteer sense, I encourage everyone, if this interests you, if you want to be an EMT, a firefighter, help out your fire community, go visit the firehouse. If the doors are open, someone's there. Go say hello and learn about your local community.
Matthew Troy and Jim O'Neill, Corey Kelly, thank you all for being here, and thank you for your service. Thank you really for what you do, and thanks for joining us in this conversation today on Where We Live. It was great fun. If you want to continue this conversation, go online. It's WNPR.org. Our program is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankowski. Have a great weekend.